I first met BBM in 41.
We're talking about Chicago Showmanship Station, the WBBM Air Theater, the Talk of Chicago with Mel Belairs, who contributed so very much to WBBM. Mel, when did you first come to WBBM?
Well, I did some auditions as a very young, amateurish character trying to be professional in 41. Mm-hmm. That's when the soap operas were all the big things. And I was trying to get a job either as an announcer, selling soap flakes or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of walking up to that second floor reception and doing a lot of auditions with sweaty palms and mm-hmm. A choking throat, because those were my really nervous days. And so that was my first experience with the Wrigley Building and what WBBM meant. I left for the war and came back in 46 and got a job at CFL. Mm-hmm. And I stayed at CFL until 50. And then I went to freelance television. I felt that the challenge of TV was so great, I had to get involved. And then in 1955, I was called by their program director, whose name I had lost, Al, but you could find that out. And he asked me if I would do an acting part. They were doing a sales presentation for all of the CBS sales force. Mm-hmm. And they were doing a showcase of talent, and would I take the part of the salesman who was selling the station? Mm-hmm. So I came in and learned my lines, and we did a show. This was an audience show in the theater.
This was for TV?
No, this was for radio.
For radio. Mm-hmm.
And after that was over, they came to me and said, how would you like to join our stable? And I said, well, I think it sounds good, because at that point, the coax cable had come into television, mm-hmm. and I was seeing whole careers last 13 weeks. And by this time, I was developing a fairly large family with a lot of kids to clothe mm-hmm. and educate, mm-hmm. and I thought that the road to security was probably in radio, and I really liked radio better because of its intimacy, mm-hmm. because of the grabbing of one mind to another. And so I said, all right, I'll do it. On the first day of May, good old May 1, 1955, I became a staff announcer. No guarantees, nothing. Making station breaks and sitting down in a dismal little studio listening to Ma Perkins and doing network cutaways and things like that. But fairly rapidly after that, I began to get my chance. The first chance was an interview show in grocery stores called Lucky Ladies for Thomas J. Webb Coffee. And that was a difficult show to do because, you know, shows in grocery stores are always tough. Either you have 5,000 women all climbing down your neck or you have nobody and you still have to do a show. But that gave me good exposure through the town that I still feel to this day. I would give away coffee and silver dollars, and I still have people walk up to me and say, hey, I have that same silver dollar that you gave me, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. Then I was the first one who got a chance to play records on BBM. Les Atlas was violently opposed to recorded music. But they said in some high-level meeting, well, why don't we try it on the weekends? So they gave me two big blocks of time, Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon, 12 to 5 both days. And I then sat down with Lenny Kaye, the world's greatest technician in music, in the record library, and I started to listen to and build programs. I had done a lot of them when I worked at CFL. Mm-hmm. I was one of the early days of, I hate the term disc jockey, but I suppose that's what I mm-hmm. was. And I started to put together these two weekend shows, and they became very successful. And that kind of opened the door then to the future use of records.
Why was Mr. Atlas opposed to recorded music?
He wanted his stations to be live, showmanship, mm-hmm. and he looked down on records as being a kind of a third-class citizen to broadcast.
It would have been the easy way out as far as the budget is concerned.
Oh, no question. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and CBS had a full orchestra. They had musicians coming out your ears mm-hmm. and the King's Jesters, whole groups of performers, and they were doing all kinds of live things, and they just never bowed down to the current type of radio that mm-hmm. is just nothing but recorded mm-hmm. music. Mm-hmm. And I respected that, and I was appreciative of the fact that I got a chance to kind of open the door. So I tried to do more than just play records. I tried to be timely. I tried to relate to people and tried to talk about things that were going on. Because when you're doing 8 or 9 hours of programming over a weekend, you play a lot of music.
Mm-hmm.
And from the very beginning, my feeling was that I needed to be free to pick the music, that that was the only art form, the only expression, the only medium that I had to create from. So I insisted on being in charge of my own music, and they always gave me that. So I played a very wide spectrum of music, and I think I was important in starting some careers, actually, because Chicago is a wonderful market and BBM is a huge voice.
Mm-hmm.
I noticed the likes of Harry Belafonte very early, and performers like Harry would come to visit me, and we'd sit and we'd talk, and we got to know each other. I began to feel the folk music as it was being developed.
Mm-hmm.
I began to feel ethnic music, like the Irish music, the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. So I followed trends in music. Mm-hmm. I didn't like straight rock music, and I almost never... I would include it from time to time, certain things. You can't exclude the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
But I never really liked it very much, and I was fairly specific about the things that I thought were good. I've never been a Barbara Streisand fan. I'm probably the only one in the world. But I look on her as being hard, brittle, and so forth and so on. And I expressed opinions, and people would call, and we would talk, and it became a very nice program. I started my Christmas show on WBBM in 1955, and I've done it every year since. This will be my 33rd year.
Christmas Around the World.
Christmas Around mm-hmm. the World, yeah. The music of Christmas in many different countries. And it just happened. I didn't set out to do it. What happened was that I was naturally going to be on the air because I was doing this long Saturday and long mm-hmm. Sunday, and I thought, well, I'd like to do something a little different because we're right here at Christmas. And so the idea just came to me. I think I'll look around through the library, look around through the music from different countries. I went over to the library and got a couple of books, and that's how it all began. Mm-hmm. It was not a definite attempt of, now I will create a Christmas show.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
It just happened like Topsy. And I got very good results the first year, and then I just continued it. And BBM was very kind. They would just let me have my head, and they let me run. And this was mm-hmm. the thing that I think I appreciated about WBBM. If they felt you had a creative urge, mm-hmm. an idea, there was nobody with a computer, there was no one saying, well, but to get the greatest number of audience points, we have to do this, we have to cater to this audience or that audience. It was freedom. And I think that's why BBM did so very well. It was then shortly after about 59 that we got an idea for a live music show. By this time I was doing a lot of live stuff with Len Cleary, who played the organ. Mm-hmm. We put together music shows. You've heard about Len. And small groups doing shows around dinner time. But we got an idea for a live morning show. And we called it the Music Wagon. And we started out early in the morning, and we would just go. The orchestra never had the opportunity to do enough rehearsal, so a lot of it was very, very spontaneous.
Mm-hmm.
But we had some of the finest musicians I've ever heard. And it was all pretty much ad-lib. I'm an ad-lib person, mm-hmm. as you know from listening, I suppose. And so we had such excitement in putting it together. People would come to visit, like Al Hurt and Rosemary Clooney. People, whenever they'd come through town, they'd come to us and perform. When Arthur Godfrey would come to town, he'd come and visit. And he would sing with the band, and it became a very live, it was live radio. We were probably the only live radio station left in the country at that point.
I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's true.
And it broke our collective hearts when in 65, we got caught by the bottom line
mm-hmm.
of by putting a man who plays records in a studio. you can do very well, and the costs are And by that time, they were having a difficult time with the musicians' union. Negotiations were very tough, and so I have to assume, although I do not know, that the word came down from the big black building in New York, cancel the musicians. And so all the live musicians went out. This was very hard. And shortly after that time, then we went to talk radio. And I had never done talk radio, but yeah, they said, now BBM is going to become talk radio, and I think all the network O&Os became talk radio at that time. And so we started now into the talk phase. We had left the music phase, the entertainment phase. Now we went into talk. That has developed into quite a thing across the country, and now you see so much talk radio. We began it in Chicago. It began at WBBM, and they brought in people who were good at talk, and some of them were extremely inflammatory in style. I never was. I tried to do talk looking for information, trying to find out how an individual thought. I never saw much fun in putting in the same studio, say, a Jesse Jackson and the Ku Klux Klan, because that kind of an interview is predictable, although there are a lot of people who will listen to that kind of radio, I think, for the sheer joy of listening to people fight. It's like watching people jump off a roof or watching a fire or being fascinated at a train accident. They brought in a young man named Jerry Williams from Boston. I'd never heard of this kind of radio before, and he was the type. They asked me to interview him the first day he came to town, and he came into one of my shows, and we were introduced, and I started to talk to him, and the first thing he did was take off on the Kennedy family. I mean, really, he took off on them. I was sitting there thinking, Jerry, you're in Chicago with an awful lot of people who look at the Kennedys as being next to God. Yeah. But that was his style. And he became very successful at it. He didn't stay in the market long. I think he went back to Boston. I think he's there now. But the inflammatory type of MC was just beginning in those days. Lord knows they've gone far beyond those days. It was shortly after that time that I was asked to do a show with Dr. Freda Kim, who was the first psychologist on the air. Now we were in the process of taking live telephone calls, not just talk radio, but giving an audience a chance to talk back. And that became an important part of the station, and her ratings just went out of sight because the women all loved it, and a lot of the guys would drive listening, looking for something live where people are really talking and communicating. And they would drive around just being in spasms at some of the answers that Dr. Kim would give. There were times when I nearly fell off my chair, too. But that was for a product named Miracle White. And we took Miracle White from a little tiny operation. A man mixed it up in his bathtub on the north side of Chicago. He sold it for $7 million. Yeah. Dr. Freda Kim was largely responsible for that because her power and her... She was like everybody's little grandma. She was almost like a New Yorker cartoon. God rest her soul. She may be dead now. Last time I saw her, she was in a nursing home. But she had power. The power of believability.
She was giving advice a la Ann Landers.
Yes. Well, mostly on how to raise your children. It was mostly geared around the terrible twos and the such and such threes and how to treat them when they become four and five, and how to help them in school. And she got into all kinds of very sensitive areas in the rearing of children. That was her basic thing. That was middle 60s. And then I got an urge to... I had done about everything on WBBM that I could do. So I started looking around for a radio station that I could buy where I could have the fun of saying, well, now what we want to do is this and this and this. And it was also about that same time that WBBM and all of the network stations switched from talk to all news. And there were many people who thought that I left WBBM because I didn't like the all news format. That wasn't true. I was already in negotiations to buy a station, so that I could try the one area of radio that I had never experienced long before that. But I think it was a good move because I don't think that just doing news would have satisfied that urge that brought me to WBBM in the first place. By this time, of course, H. Leslie Atlas was gone. Ernie Shomo, the general manager, had died. Ernie was my good friend. Mm-hmm. He was sort of my patron. I never signed a contract with WBBM, never. Ernie and I shook hands. And from time to time, I would go back into Ernie and say, Ernie, I'm bringing in a lot of dollars over the transom. How about a few more for the Belairs tribe? And he'd say, okay, what do you need? And I would tell him. And he'd say, okay. And that's how we lived.
Wonderful way to negotiate.
It was an exciting time. And I look on my days at WBBM, because I've been in this market now solidly from the 40s, mid-40s. The days at BBM were the greatest because they were challenging, exciting. You never needed any kind of high material because you'd get so high on the air with this feeling of we're saying something, we're getting somewhere, we are really showmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And that was encouraged. And we were left pretty much free. I worked with some wonderful people. And naturally, the people who come through Chicago, whether they're scientists or entertainers, I think I've probably had a chance to meet most of them. And most of them are wonderful to meet.
You've been in the catbird seat for so many years with WBBM.
Yeah.
Everybody would certainly want to come to BBM and would want to come and visit Mal Belairs.
Yeah. And can you believe I voluntarily left? There were people, many of them, who said, Belairs, you're absolutely stark raving mad. No one ever leaves WBBM. And that is almost the truth. You almost die or are thrown out the window. And BBM has been fairly ruthless over the years about its policy of, let me just unplug that thing.
I was just wondering what it was.
Yeah, it's just let me unplug it for just a minute here. Turn it off. Okay. What I was saying when the coffee pot took off was that BBM was always fairly ruthless. By that I mean that H. Leslie Atlas knew what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
He would never come around to you and give you instructions. I want you to do this or that or that. But he knew what he wanted. And he got it. And if he didn't get it, out you went. And he didn't say, I'll give you 2 weeks' notice. He would say, clean out your desk, goodbye. And I think that's the proper policy in broadcasting, because you don't want someone sitting around on your microphone who is an irate...
Who's unhappy.
Oh, yeah. You can't have that because they can kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have always looked on H. Leslie Atlas as being probably the smartest man in radio that I have ever met. He was absolutely brilliant. Kept a very low profile. Was really tough, but he was fair, and he knew broadcasting. And that's how he built WBBM to what it was. I was very sorry, in a way... to leave that organization. But I had this desire at that time. I was 50, and I thought, well, Belairs, if you're ever going to see what it's like to sit on the other side of the desk, maybe you ought to try it now. But I've maintained very good relationships with BBM all through the years, do lots of spots on the station. Mm-hmm. I left in very good terms. They gave me a nice big farewell party that I will never forget, and that hasn't always... been that way. Sometimes the leavings have not been so good for lots of people.
Well, radio is a funny business.
You have to be in business, you have to be fairly tough. And I know that.
When the station went to all news, which was in, I think, May of 68.
It's
20 years now. It's almost 20 years. You then were performing.
Oh, yes, and I became all news.
Now, exactly what were you doing?
All right, I was the main desk?
Anchor?
I was an anchor man, sure. Mm-hmm. I was the anchor man from 11 until 2. And that included the Dr. Kim show. Then we would go on into news, and then I would be doing news. And it was also at that time that my first wife, Jo, and I developed a program called Mal and Jo on the Go, which to this day, you can see reflected in the programming on WBBM. Mm-hmm. Sherman Kaplan does restaurant reviews and show reviews. We did that, I think, as some of the first in Chicago, reaching out into the market mm-hmm. and saying, radio is a good way to tell people what's going on. Newspapers have always done it, but for some reason, radio hadn't done it. Radio was doing more of a come to us and we'll entertain you.
Uh-huh.
We'll give
uh-huh.
you the pap that you can listen to like your own record player. But we would go to theaters. We would go to nightclub openings. Great fun. Very mm-hmm. exciting. Takes a lot of time and energy.
Yeah.
And we would go to restaurants and we would build our 5 and 10 minute segments, maybe 10 or 15, and they'd be played on the station throughout the week. So I did do the news work until I left the station in mid-October of 1969
mm-hmm.
and opened up my own stations on November 1st. We moved in on Halloween.
Oh.
Trick or treat. Try your own hand.
WIVS in Crystal Lake.
Yes.
That was the first station, right.
And then we bought the station in Woodstock, mm-hmm. the FM station, which at that time we called WXRD. So we had the AM and the FM mm-hmm. lockout in this area, which was exciting. I loved it. It was challenging. My wife and I had always wanted to work together. She was a very fine performer and had given it all up to raise our seven
mm-hmm.
kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that this was a good opportunity for both of us to work on a family project and to build it up and to then eventually sell it. And that would be the annuity that would buy the bread and beans when I got old enough that I shouldn't be on main stage anymore. Mm-hmm. It was sort of our retirement policy.
And through those years, though, while you had the stations, you continued to do a lot of freelance work.
Oh, yes.
in Chicago.
And I still do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Wouldn't even know about White Fence Farm.
Yeah, there are those who think I own a piece of the restaurant. But I've had a wonderful relationship mm-hmm. with Bob and Doris Hastert. I was in my office one afternoon after getting off the air. The phone rang, and the voice on the other end said, Mr. Belairs? I said, yes. She said, this is Doris Hastert. Doris Hastert. And she said, we have a little restaurant. Do you know about us? And I really didn't, because it's southwest mm-hmm. of the city, and I've been north and west mm-hmm. all my life. She said, well, we'd really like you to talk about us the way you talk about Honey Bear Farm. At that time, Carson's had a very nice restaurant mm-hmm. up here in North. And I said, well, fine. I'd like to come out and see your restaurant. And she said, well, when can you come? And I said, well, how about tomorrow? She said, why don't you come for breakfast? So I said, all right, I'll bring one of our salespeople. And I took Mel Pinzel, who was one of the all-time great salesmen. And we went down and had breakfast in their kitchen, having fried chicken, and thoroughly fell in love with the place, and I've been doing their commercials ever since. One word about the sales staff mm-hmm. at BBM. Absolutely the greatest. Don Mann, who is now dead, was the greatest salesman I've ever known. And he was the complete salesman, because he not only was out to sell you time, but if he was going to zero in on your company, he would learn your company. He would know your advertising. He would know the date of your birthday. He would know the date of your wife's birthday and your anniversary. And when you went out to eat, usually to have lunch, Don smoked his big black cigars, he could tell you more about your company than you knew.
Mm-hmm.
So when he made a presentation, the client immediately got the feeling, my Lord, this man really is on my side. He was not a time salesman. He was your complete consultant, and I learned from him. And I would often go with Don,
mm-hmm.
and then with Mel Pinzel, who followed pretty much the same line. I think WBBM, over the years, developed the greatest time salesman I've ever known anywhere.
Do you think this was as a result of the attitude of Mr. Atlas, that these people took their job seriously like that?
Yes, I do.
He said, hey, you're going to sell.
That's the
way to sell.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted results.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted results. And he got results. And they worked hard at their jobs. But I think it all started right at the top.
Well, it has to.
Sure.
It has to. You, from what you've said and what others have said, too, Mr. Atlas was so much involved in interested in the programming. It wasn't just liver sausage on the rack. It was programming.
That's right.
And sales. He wanted to be able to deliver, and they really need to go together.
Absolutely.
And that's really fantastic, fantastic station over the years.
Well, I'm sure that as you have talked to other people, you will form your own opinions as to what people thought of all the components.
Mm-hmm.
But as I sit here with you, Chuck, I have never, ever had anything but the greatest pride in being able to say I was part of WBBM. I still feel that I'm a part of WBBM. Right now I'm writing commercials over there for North Shore Magazine that will be on WBBM next week.
Mm-hmm.
And many times when clients come to me and say, how do we advertise? I look on the news operation as being great. In the very beginning, I didn't. I did not quite see the potential for an all-news station. But they made a believer out of me. There was a niche for it, and a niche for it all across the country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as I travel around and hear other stations of the CBS variety doing the all-news, I realized that there were some pretty smart old boys who switched it that way. Because one thing that news does, it doesn't let talent wag the tail. Often, if you have really strong personalities, the personalities begin to dictate the policy of the station. This shouldn't go on the air. But
right.
I cite Howard Miller as a good
mm-hmm.
example on
mm-hmm.
IND. Howard Miller became so powerful that Howard Miller was dictating what happened mm-hmm. on WIND. And that's when Ralph Atlas and Howard and you know all these things. These are not for air,
yeah,
but
I understand.
Talent can be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If talent becomes too strong, then they can make it very difficult.
Well, yeah, that's evident in so many of the rock and roll stations today.
Absolutely.
Where the disc jockeys, the personalities yep. get so strong that the station management is at a loss to
yeah.
control them.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to take a break while we turn over the tape because I've got some more things to ask. Mel, I want to back up a little bit and talk about the scene at WBBM when you first came there in 55. This was still at the Wrigley Building?
Yes.
And where did you work?
My favorite building in the whole world. I loved BBM. Oh, the bank was on the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
There were studios and control room and recording rooms down in the lower level, actually, be a basement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where all of the network programming came in. That's where Lenny Kaye had all the records. That's where they did the duplication of shows. And by golly, when I first went there, they were doing them on the big discs.
Mm-hmm.
That was before we had the tape recorders. So they were recording on big transcriptions. I worked mostly on the second floor, where we had a number of studios. And I just thought of an interesting thing. I did the last show in the Wrigley Building on a Sunday afternoon, just before we moved over to the old arena
uh-huh.
where the studios are now. And I took my microphone and walked out into the halls where there were just nothing but echoes and cardboard boxes piled with files. And I walked up and down the hall talking about the ghosts of what had happened uh-huh. in the Wrigley Building. Phew, that was really incredible. But when I first went there, to back up, in 1955, most of the soap operas had moved. Where they had been originating here in Chicago
mm-hmm.
at NBC in the Merchandise Mart and in the Wrigley Building, they were now either in New York or in Los Angeles. So that programming was just carried on the network. But the live programs were still being done out of the various live studios. Jim Conway was a very strong and powerful MC, strong personality. Josh Brady was at the station. good man. Josh and I have worked together for years. Mm-hmm. And we had the King's Jesters. We had George Watson. We had the Gold Coast Hour, which was nothing but a dramatic dialogue that linked together dozens of commercials in a 50-minute. Are you familiar with the Gold
Coast?
Sure,
yeah. Absolutely.
I used to be amazed at how the man who wrote that was named Mort. Mort? Lost his last name.
I know.
But he would take 8 or 10 or 12 commercials, and he would create some sort of dramatic scene. Corny, crazy, mm-hmm. comic, and then George Watson and the King's Jesters would put all this together with different voices, and it was unbelievable.
And they got a lot more commercials in that quarter hour than they would have otherwise.
It was the top grossing show on the station. It was solid commercial.
3 times a day, I think.
Yes,
they did that.
Yes, you know the show. Yeah. So that was one of the big shows. There was almost always something going from one studio mm-hmm. to another studio to another studio. At present time, most radio stations have carved their necessary space down tremendously, mm-hmm. but in those days, we had great luxury, and I maintain there's nothing as exciting as working in the Wrigley Building and walking out on that street at Christmas time or middle of summer and being a part of Chicago on Michigan Avenue. I dearly love the Wrigley Building, and I was sorry when we left because the feeling was different. It was economics, of course, mm-hmm. that put radio and television together in what had been the old ice skating arena, mm-hmm. right across the street from where I had worked as a young announcer at CFL. So it put me right back in the same area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. BBM really, when they consolidated and moved to the arena, then they had the main floor, the main was for television, and the radio was wrapped around. But they did build some pretty decent studios for radio.
Oh, yes, they certainly did.
At the arena, McClurg Court.
Sure.
And the Music Wagon, was that developed at McClurg Court?
Yes.
You weren't doing that at the Wrigley Building?
No, no. That was 1960 we went on the air with mm-hmm. the Music Wagon. And I don't remember the exact date of when we moved mm-hmm. over there. I'm sure you've got that date. But it was at least, I think, 2 years later. Mm-hmm. And there were times when we had whole choruses of people in the guest on Music Wagon where we would use 2 studios. And I would gallop during a commercial from one studio to the other studio and then back to the orchestra. And we had audiences, too. So we would it was a very live and active thing.
How big an audience would you have?
Oh, sometimes. We didn't advertise mm-hmm. for an audience. Mm-hmm. But we would have groups that just wanted to come and see a radio show. Mm-hmm. We'd have maybe 20, 30 people. Mm-hmm. It was not an attempt to create an audience situation.
Yeah.
But there were always people who wanted to come and see the show. George Walsh was the producer of the mm-hmm. show. And good old Irish George Walsh, we used to have a great time with him because he, as a director-producer, was very loose also. And there were no holds barred. And sometimes Hollywood actresses would come in who were difficult, and the band would loosen them up and laugh at them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it all became a family affair.
Now, what would a Hollywood actress do on the show?
Well, Jane Mansfield came in one time carrying her little dog, and just to be interviewed about some movie that she was coming out with. And the band, you can't get around a group of musicians. They're a wild bunch. And I said to Jane, I said, Jane, there is one question I want to ask you. And she looked at me and said, I'll bet there is. And the band just went up in smoke. And there were some other things that happened that were, I guess, were rather blue, that weren't intentional, but just came out blue. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there were some instances where Hal Carton would be seen sitting under the piano, just about to die. And we had a great trumpet man named Porky Panico. And, he had Art Van Damme and his quintet on the station mm-hmm. for a good run. And they were something.
Now, you say this was on in the morning.
Yes.
10 o'clock?
7 to 9.
7 to 9.
Yeah.
2 full hours, just live entertainment.
Yeah.
This was before anybody ever used the term morning drive.
That's right. Yeah, we did. We never heard the term morning drive.
You weren't thinking in terms of entertaining the audience in their cars.
No. No. It hadn't really... we hadn't really been that concerned about numbers or who the audience was. We were thinking more about good shows. I almost never paid any attention to what ratings were. I know there were ratings being taken, but they didn't affect us in any way. Nobody ever said to me, Belairs, your rating is going down. What are you going to do to hype this thing? Well, we're going to have a contest and give away 10 acres on the moon. We never did anything like that. We never really much considered it. Very unsophisticated radio, maybe.
Yeah, but maybe better. Maybe better.
We weren't concerned that much with the economics. Mm-hmm. We knew that Music Wagon was sponsored. It would be sponsored by major companies in like 15-minute blocks. And they paid a lot of money for the 15-minute block. Johnson & Johnson was on, just countless national clients.
The basic rating would be whether Johnson & Johnson was selling more of their product because of the exposure on your program. You talk about White Fence Farm or the other... was it the bleach or the...
Miracle White.
Miracle White, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, if business is good, he's not going to fuss with that, no matter what the ratings are.
You're right. Mm-hmm. You're right. And I think that was probably the main philosophy. Mm-hmm. Do we get results? Do we deliver more customers? We can prove it. Give us the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And then we did it.
Which is where Mr. Atlas, for example, said, you do this on the air, these people sell it, and as long as we've got sponsors lined up to buy this, station is profitable, we're doing it right.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. As the years went by, and I suppose you'll do research on this, I think Les became a vice president of the network, and I think... gradually, his total authority on WBBM was diminished. Is that right?
Well, he became more involved with the corporate CBS in its Chicago operation than with the so-called hands-on operation of WBBM AM.
Yeah.
And, of course, what happened, too, over those from the arena years on, television was really taking a greater hold of the network's interest.
That's right.
And that was, of course, to the detriment of radio. And as the network radio shows went off the air in the early 50s, all of that stuff was replaced on so many stations that we were talking before by the disc jockeys and the music, yet WBBM stayed there with live programs and creative things on the air.
To their eternal credit. The world became enamored with the new boy in town, the new toy. TV was the new toy. And it's a very good toy, I might add. Mm-hmm. But still, I think that, as in most cases, the pendulum swung too far. They all talked about the death of radio. Radio never died.
Mm-mm.
And then, of course, when the transistor came in, and the automobile radio came in, and then stereo came in, I think radio is very strong and very healthy.
It's as strong as it ever was, and maybe stronger.
Yeah.
Maybe stronger.
Because it goes everywhere, and it goes with immediacy that TV, for all of its conversation and minicams, can't really match, I don't think.
You know, when I talk about the old days of radio and replay the classic shows and that sort of thing, we always tend to get into the theater of the mind and the fact that you participate with that radio because of your imagination. You're providing the pictures where the broadcaster is providing the sounds and that sort of thing. And even though in the 50s and beyond, when there wasn't much situation, comedy, drama, mystery, whatever, on radio, the personalities, like yourself, came in there. You provided the picture... You provided the basis for the listener to draw a picture from what you were saying. And millions of listeners out there would say, well, what does he look like? Doesn't matter what you look like. It's they have in their mind an image of the person talking to them. And radio is much more intimate than television ever can be, I think. Because you're I know, I've been a fan of yours and listened to you for all those years. I'm early on with Camelot on Sunday afternoons, and all of the the Clancy brothers and the Harry Belafonte with the hole in the bucket and
yep. Oh, you do know.
I listen to this. Yeah. And you always talked to one person.
Yeah.
Just like Godfrey did, just like everybody should do, but don't. You talk one-on-one, and that's what brings an intimacy between you and the listener. And that's what sustains the whole thing.
I think so. I think I've always looked on radio as being the one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably I was terribly impressed with Arthur Godfrey,
mm-hmm.
that he never, ever reverted to just reading commercials.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came into the business, I decided that the strength of my being able to sell would be being able to be ad lib,
mm-hmm.
to not read. I think that your concentration is so much stronger when someone is talking to you than when someone is reading to you. So I started off from the very beginning of my earliest days at CFL. First, I would write out a whole commercial, and then I would make an outline of it and throw the whole commercial away and work from the outline. And then finally I got to the point where I could throw the outline away, and I was no longer afraid of starting, making my points, and coming to a close, logically.
Mm-hmm.
I think that for most of us in the business, when we first start out, there is fear. There's that chaos that boils around in your mind of, oh boy, what do I do if I freeze and can't get out of this thing? And that's why people go back to reading. It's the easy way out. But it is so wonderful when at long last, with the practice that it takes of how many years, you feel comfortable enough to be able to just say, hey, and then go through it and make it believable and talk to a person. It's the most exciting medium. It's like being a brain surgeon. The feeling of accomplishment is great.
Satisfying. Now, today, to bring us up to date on Mel Belair's Today, you are still doing freelance commercial work?
Yes.
And what else?
Well, let's see. My freelance work consists of my wife and I do restaurant reviews, mm-hmm. and travel reports for North Shore Magazine, which gave me a chance to write.
Mm-hmm.
I never had the opportunity to write. We were just talking. It's all been ad-lib, talk, mm-hmm. talk, talk. And so I'm now writing. And I'm doing a lot of work with an agency in Milwaukee that I have worked with for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's TV and radio. And I'm doing a lot of commercials around the Chicago market yet. And it keeps me just busy enough. I did get a little tired of the 3 and 4 hour grinds. And I also felt that when I got to be 60, it would be advisable to figure out a way to gracefully start to disengage. I think that most performers get too involved with the heady joy of being on stage. I think we tend to stay too long. And I think you have to learn when to make an exit. You have to learn when the show should logically close. And so while I have not just dropped the hammer on Belair's and said, okay, that's it, now I'm just going to sit by the sidelines, I am doing just certain things that I consider to be great fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We bought a house in Ireland way back in 1971, which we enjoy tremendously. We go there for about 3 months every summer. And I have a studio in Limerick, Ireland, where I can go and record commercials, and I get communiques from clients back here, and I go down to Limerick and record the spot, put them on a UPS flight back here,
mm-hmm.
and so that's fun. And we now have very good friends in Ireland, so I feel as if I keep 1 foot in the United States, mm-hmm. and 1 foot in Ireland. I have no desire to become a full-time Irish citizen,
mm-hmm.
but we do love the people and love the area, and we spend quite a bit of time there. So there's a lot of travel involved for us. This spring I was in Korea. I went on a writing assignment for North Shore Magazine. And last year I did an article in depth on France. The year before that I went to the People's Republic of China for North Shore Magazine, did a big article on that. I like to take my own pictures, and that's a new area too of photography. And I do enjoy travel writing. So I'm very busy, just enough, but not trying to any longer stay on center stage.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you are ever present, because we listen to radio and hear your voice. So it's not like whatever happened to Mel Belairs, you're right there.
Well, that's not on a regular basis. Yeah. That is the nicest thing, that when I go places, naturally, people come up and they feel that I've never left.
Mm-hmm.
And this market has been so good to me. I've had opportunities to go to other markets, but I think I'm one of the few who's never moved out of my original area.
Were you born in the Chicago area?
No. I was born in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and raised on a cattle ranch in Colorado. I came back here in 1941 to direct a summer theater in Milwaukee. I had gone to the Pasadena Playhouse, a theater school out in Pasadena, and left the Milwaukee area, came down here in the fall of 1941, just in time for Pearl Harbor, and time to meet my the girl who was to become my wife, who was a writer in Chicago, and a darn good one. Then off to the war for 4 years till 1946. And then back here, I'll never forget the first day I got a job, my first job. Do you have time for this?
Sure, of course.
I had been making the rounds, having come out of the Army, and that's a desperately lonely feeling when you've been involved in the Army. You get into that security feeling that the Army provides, and here I was with a wife and a baby and another one on the way, and here I am walking the streets of Chicago looking for a job. And so one of the stations I had visited frequently was WCFL. Program director was a very nice man named Bob Platt. And I'd asked Bob if he had any work, and no, he didn't. But I kept going back. One day he called me and said, "Mal, I have an announcer named Jimmy Dudley who's going on vacation for a week. Would you be interested in doing a week?" You bet I would. So I went in and became a staff announcer at CFL May 1, 1946. Everything happened to me on May the 1st. And about Wednesday of that week, Jimmy Dudley called in. He had gotten a job as a play-by-play announcer, I think in Cleveland or something like that. And so he wouldn't be coming back. So Bob said, "Mal, would you like a permanent job?" I never forget that night, Chuck. The studios were in the old Furniture Mart over 66 Lakeshore Drive. And I walked across town and down Michigan Avenue, and all of a sudden I felt, I belong to the city now. I am working in the kind of work I want to do. And I was 10 feet tall. It is the greatest night of my life, because I had made it. $62.50 a week. Split shifts. Freelance shows. I mean, on remote talent shows, got you $5, maybe $10. My dream was to make as much as $100 a week. So you see, you start out, economics were different then, but still, I had achieved something very important. I was working in the kind of work I wanted to be in. And I've always said to my kids, the Belairs philosophy says simply that you shouldn't waste your time in life doing something you don't like to do. That you, whatever it is, first of all, like your job, and then success will come along, or whether it does or not, if you're happy in it, who cares? But I was doing what I wanted, with infinite opportunities in this wonderful market of Chicago. It's a great radio and television town. I was breaking in, admiring people like Bert Tilstrom and Kukla Fran and Ollie, and I bought my first television set because of watching Burr and Fran Allison perform. I thought, wow, I've got to have a television set. Then I started doing some odds and ends, crazy things on TV. And it was so exciting, because you'd go from one studio to another. You'd be on in one segment of time here, and you'd jump in a cab and tear across the bridge and whip up to the Merchandise Mart and do a commercial up there on the Clifton Utley show. And I was It was show business for me at its finest.
Well, you sure contributed an awful lot to Chicago broadcasting. You've done a tremendous amount, and I'll thank you for everybody out there in Radio Land for what you've done. I think you did a marvelous job, and you've entertained us for all those years. Now, before we wrap this up,
sure.
One last question. Two questions. You no longer have an interest in their radio stations.
No, I sold the stations to Katy Industries. Wallace Carroll, who is the head of Katy Industries, lives in Lake Forest, and he used to drive to his office in Elgin listening to the radio stations. And Wallace is quite an entrepreneur and owns dozens of different companies, from shrimp boats in South America to shoe factories in Europe to Tula Dye. He's just a huge conglomerate. And he never owned any radio stations, so they called me one day and said, if and when you ever get tired of owning the radio stations, would you talk to us? And I had just turned 60 at that time, and so I thought, well, let's talk. So we came to a very nice arrangement, and I agreed to stay on for 1 year after they took over as a transitional thing, and I stayed nearly four or so, before I finally decided, well, I want to be free to do some other things. Mm-hmm. So then I gradually bowed out. We're still very good friends, and I'll do the Christmas show again this year on those two stations. And I have very good friends up there, nice people. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed helping young people break into the business. And we have lots of young WIVS, WXRD people, talent and sales, who are now in the Chicago market and all over the place, who evidently got a pretty good course of what to do and how to do it. And now they're carrying on, and that's very satisfying, very gratifying.
You answered the question I was going to ask. Where are you going to do the Christmas show, and you're going to do it on these two Tuesdays?
Yeah, I've always done it there since I left BBM, and I have a feeling of loyalty, and we put it on both stations, and I'll do it from noon until, I think, about 4:15. It's a good show. It makes Christmas for me, and I'm sure for a lot of other people. I don't change the show very much. You don't change Christmas.
That's tradition. You don't.
So
do
it's become old-time radio now, hasn't it?
That's right. We'll have to dig up some of the early ones, and then we'll play it on old-time radio.
Yeah. It has changed some, but not tremendously. And some of the things, of course, that I did the very first year, I'm still doing. Mm-hmm. If I canceled them or changed them, the audience would rise up and strike me dead.
Yeah. How does your long, loyal following find you on the Saturday and Sunday before Christmas?
They start calling the station, usually, and saying, is he going to do the show again? And is he still alive? Things like that. And so we get a lot of people who tune in. Not as many as I had on BBM, because the signal doesn't reach out as far as a 50,000-watt station. I wish it did. But I've never tried to put the show on. I've never tried to merchandise it. I've never really gone out and looked for sponsors. I feel that the Christmas show is my opportunity to give something back and not to make money on it.
Thanks, Mel Valeris. I appreciate all this time and the great memories.
I have enjoyed every minute of it, Chuck. It's fun to meet people who know the business, who respect the business the way you obviously do.
Thank you.